fitch.edu/AI.
This is WGTD HD serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, a program that's designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show is hosted by Felicia King of Quality Plus Consulting and airs the first Saturday of every month.
Good morning. You're listening to Breakfast Bites, and I'm Felicia King. In today's show, I want to talk about document management platforms. Who needs them? What are they for? And how best to get one that works for you? So let's get started. Document management platforms are really applicable to any organization that has more than one employee. It may be even applicable in the instance that an organization has only one employee. And it's just a matter of what are their compliance requirements if they're that small. But at some point in time, you get to the size of an organization of, say, five employees or more. And you have to be concerned with things such as keeping your data organized, keeping it classified, using data retention policies. There's a lot of liability associated with improperly retaining too much. And this is true also with your email, by the way. And then you have to balance that with what you are actually retaining. And so we have to start first with policy. Everything in business should be working towards a method of operational maturity. This is how businesses need to scale. If you want to get from a one-person business to a 10-person business, you have to focus on operational maturity and being able to scale. That means utilizing systems properly, utilizing the correct systems. And given the fact that every business that's out there today is a technology business, navigating these issues without your own designated technology executive, whether you hire them on a virtual or fractional basis or on a part-time employee basis, doesn't matter. You need a technology executive. The IT support people, it's not good enough. And it's important that you understand this stuff because it's just too darn complicated. I will get into that more. And I'm talking even in the essence that you are a very small organization of, say, five employees. You still need a technology executive. I mean, unless you like to light money on fire, because that's usually what ends up happening when somebody doesn't have a technology executive. I see repeatedly where organizations will try to get by with simply just an IT director. And I have yet, in my 30 years of experience, I'm not saying that it's impossible, but I've worked with hundreds of organizations over the last 30 years. And I have yet to ever encounter an IT director that had the skill set and capabilities of a technology executive. Therefore, in the scenarios where an organization is simply relying upon an IT director or someone of that level of skill set, they are leaving themselves in a situation where they could have had a relationship with a fractional CTO, for example, but they figured that they were, you know, saving themselves money by not spending that $1,000, and instead they end up lighting hundreds of thousands of dollars on fire. I mean, it's a brief example. Is there was a scenario some years back where there was an IT director who just decided he was going to vet some new technology and come up with a solution on his own. So he basically got sold a bag of goods by some salespeople at an enormous 8,000 employee technology company. So this was, you know, they were a very large company, and I think it's naive to assume that just because they're a large company that they're not engaging in mendacity. I think it's also naive to assume that their offer is going to deliver the outcome that you need. And like I said, I have yet to be able to, I have yet to encounter an IT director that I could ever look at and say, they're doing a good enough job. And so this is not a dig on IT directors. It's a reality that you as a business decision maker, if your goal is to not light hundreds of thousands of dollars on fire, plus your payroll on an ongoing basis, you know, plus having compliance and business continuity problems and a variety of other problems, it would behoove you to use your technology executive in, at a minimum, an advisory capacity to do contract reviews and review things before you sign for some, you know, expensive purchase or large project. And so in this particular case, the IT director had done all this evaluation exclusively on their own, and the CEO of the company never required a second set of eyes on the process. So the IT director just said, oh, sign this. CEO signed it. Again, no second opinion, no advisory from anybody else, even though I can tell you in that instance, we'd had a very, very long standing, more than a decade relationship. And they migrated to this new system. And then everything started going sideways and they were having no end of issues. Well, they reach out to me in a panic because their business is being so adversely affected by the platform recommendation and the implementation done by this 8,000 person company. And I said, well, you know, send me the agreements and the contracts so that I can have an understanding about what is supposed to be happening versus what is happening. So they sent me the stuff. It took me an hour and a half to read through the things, and I wrote up comments about what was egregiously wrong. So here's what I'm telling you is that in an hour and a half of reviewing service contracts and master services agreements and things like that that were associated with this, you know, this deal, I was able to discern that there was no possible way. It was technically impossible for the customer to ever have an effective outcome with what it was that this big ginormous software company sold them. In fact, what the big ginormous software company had sold them was in stark opposition and violation of that software company's own requirements. So if you were that customer and you had put those systems on premise on your own servers that you owned, you would have to adhere to certain standards. Well, the software company in their hosted cloud platform was not meeting those minimum standards. And so what they were constantly doing, because the way that the agreement was made, is they were constantly just coming back to the customer and saying, well, all of these things are your responsibility to manage. And they wouldn't even do investigations. And they would just say, well, the solution to the problem is either you need to delete a bunch of your data or you need to spend gobs and gobs of more money. And, you know, ultimately, all of that infrastructure ended up being brought back on premise because it was absolutely economically infeasible to run it in this cloud-hosted platform. But that's not the actual moral of the story. The actual real moral of the story is if you have a chief technology officer at your disposal and you use them properly, you can avoid lighting $300,000 on fire. And I have a whole bunch of examples that I could tell you that for real world things that happened like that. So this is directly applicable to the topic of the document management platform, because so much of this is a strategic architecture choice that is centered around these things like operational maturity. What are my business processes? What's the economic impact of various processes to the organization? What are the workflows of the staff? What is possible with staff retraining? And how do you have someone who understands how to drive those kinds of inclusive decision-making processes that need to happen inside the organization in a, you know, curated, structured way, such that the stakeholders are able to have input and say, well, we've read the draft proposal for what the business processes are. We've read the requirements, and now this is our feedback. What I've seen in 100% of cases, and I've been doing document management platform implementations and design and maintenance and support since like 1997. It's been a super long time. And, you know, we're talking about platforms like Atlassian, SharePoint, World Docs, Net Documents, Laserfish. I've spent some time with iManage, but I've not done an iManage implementation yet. But, you know, it's really, frankly, no different than most of the rest of them. It's just a different software package. When you're doing a project like this, you first have to actually define your requirements. This is true if you're a one-person, three-person, or a 500-person company. You have to have a written set of requirements. Doesn't mean you can't change them over time, but you have to start with something. And then you that whole thing has to be really thought through in terms of what's the implication on our business processes? What is the implication of our burden rate or the management of that? Like, for example, if you choose to have two different platforms, then you're going to have to maintain compliance in both of those platforms. Your staff will have to search for content in those two different platforms. And that may be not great from a business process workflow. I mean, that might just be too much for the user base. You know, this is something that has to be considered. When you're using a platform like iManage versus using SharePoint for a document management platform, then you are going to be much, like, I would argue that the vast majority of your behavior is probably going to be focused on cost management. The reason for this is because iManage is a document management platform, similarly to Laserfish, similarly to World Docs, similarly to Net Documents. These things all use somebody else's servers. So they're using like Amazon Web Services or Microsoft Azure for their hosting. Okay, in those circumstances, that stuff is not cheap. And all of those costs are then passed on to the customer with a markup. Everybody has to have email and a document storage system and like a chat application and a variety of other things that are just included in Microsoft 365. I mean, the vast, vast, vast majority of businesses worldwide and organizations worldwide use Microsoft 365. With that, you are inherently already receiving quite a lot of storage. Let's take, for example, you have 100 users. You're getting 1 terabyte of storage per user for their OneDrive. And you could even buy more if you wanted to. With that 100 users of licensing, you also get a very significant chunk of SharePoint storage. So I have yet to encounter a scenario in the last 8 years where somebody really needs a file server on-premise. And I have to share with you something crucially important because myths need to be dispelled. If you've gone around and talked to people who have attempted to use SharePoint as a document management platform in the past, I believe that whatever they're telling you about their past experiences is not applicable in today's current climate. And I'm speaking from things have changed even in the last 2 weeks. And Microsoft is absolutely working on this all of the time. Doesn't mean that this is like immature, untested technologies. The customizations and the underlying like compliance, document retention, document classification, document automation processes. I mean, these are things that have been around very mature in the Microsoft 365 platform for at least 8 years. SharePoint Advanced Premium, though, was not a thing up until fairly recently. And it doesn't mean that some things couldn't be done properly before, but it means that now with Advanced Premium licensing and with the implementation of Purview and then some methods and technologies that facilitate enabling organizational staff to actually do things like sharing and document workflow approvals and, you know, all of those things that you would normally expect out of a document management platform. Now, with that technology, you can just have not only all of your file server being replaced by SharePoint, but you can also replace something like iManage, WorldDocs, NetDocuments. So I've done migrations for SEC-regulated entities that had a 35-year document retention policy into SharePoint with, you know, thousands of clients. So very complex stuff. I mean, one of the things that you have to be aware of is that there's no instruction manual for most of these things. So you do have to find somebody who really understands all of these technologies, as well as how to integrate everything. And that integration and interaction effect is the most critical piece. So in an ideal world, you would find that CTO that has the ability to write the document retention policy, to write the data classification policy, to write the automations and the workflows and to document the processes, to write the end user training documentation, to conduct the end user training, to create business continuity documentation for these things, to have the skill set of an enterprise security architect to do the implementation in a secure way. And it should also be observed that I have yet to ever experience a situation where the implementation was able to be strictly outsourced to the document management platform software company or their consulting partner. So for example, if you look at like NetDocuments, there are NetDocuments partners. I've never seen a situation where a NetDocuments partner has an enterprise security architect on staff. Same thing with Laserfish, same thing with other technologies. In fact, I would argue that most IT service providers don't actually have an enterprise security architect on staff. And if they do, then they don't have the business experience. They don't have the business process experience. So it's really hard to find people that can do these things properly, which is why it's so darned pivotal and important for you to get consultation with a highly qualified CTO before you go and say, hey, I'm going to make a strategic decision that's now going to affect my organization for the next 20, 30 years. And then I'm going to go spend, you know, $100,000 on an implementation or whatever, you know, whatever that happens to be. Some technologies also only make sense at a certain flooring level. Like, what's the flooring for NetDocuments? What's the practical flooring for Laserfish? What's the practical flooring for iManage? And the answer to those things is different. And again, these are things that I would argue most IT directors don't understand how to handle that, and they typically don't even ask that question. I've also encountered where every single time I've seen a proposal slash, you know, proposed contract or service agreement from one of these companies, something has to be modified. So oftentimes what has to be modified is that, no, you're not going to get admin access into the rest of the infrastructure, or things have to be modified to be in compliance with the cyber policies of the organization associated with remote access, user support, these sorts of things. And when I've encountered scenarios where I will be pushing for a contract change, I've heard come back and they'll say to me, well, well, we'll just put a note in our CRM on your account. And I'm like, no, I don't think that's good enough. We need a mechanism whereby we can ensure that your team has been contractually communicated to clearly that this is the support protocol we expect to use. And so I'll go and I'll get that contract modification in there, and you know, the project is moving forward. And then sure enough, within the first 30 days, typically sooner, some sort of a support protocol thing is coming up in question, and it's not in the CRM. And even if it was in the CRM, I don't think anybody looked at the CRM, because I went and I'd go and I'd ask this person, say, so that's not part of our protocol. And I've had times where I will add to that engagement contract, one, two, or three page document that says, this is the general approach that we want to use for this project. And so that puts it's almost like having a customer side initiated statement of work that controls the mechanisms or kind of controls the tenor of the engagement. Because otherwise what will happen is that consulting firm is trying to stick you in their box. And usually that ends up with project constipation and the project goes nowhere. And then there's finger pointing and people are grumpy. And every single time that I have successfully managed to get these contract enhancements or modifications done with the intent, obviously, of driving clarity between the parties, I have had to refer to those repeatedly. And you just got to understand that if you don't have a CTO to help you navigate these complexities, it's not going to be a good thing for you. And this is my experience from the last 30 years. So in that instance where, you know, there's a different support protocol and there is this add-on, which is basically saying, this is how we're going to do the project, and everybody was supposed to be on the same page. Again, every single time, I'm finding that the project kickoff engineer, that the consulting firm that works for the software company is, you know, handing off the project to, well, they didn't read that. And so they'll try taking the whole thing and putting it in their normal little box, and then I'll have to refer back to the contract and say, hey, did you get a copy of the contract? Have you looked at the last three pages? Because, you know, all of these things that you're asking about, these have already been answered there. You know, these were part of the discovery and agreement phase. So when you have a CTO who understands business, legal, contract, economics, and, you know, flooring, burden rates, and everything from implementation, you know, requirements creation, implementation to completion, and then support, ongoing support, and user enablement, and you get that person involved before you sign, then you will have the best outcome and you will not be lighting money on fire. And it seems to be, I encounter it fairly regularly, and it's just so disappointing. It's so avoidable. I don't understand why people do it other than they think they're saving themselves $1,000. They will not get the right people involved. They will not work from a written set of requirements. They will not have evaluated a platform against their business processes because nobody actually documented the business processes. So the business processes can't be integrated into the requirements. And when you don't have things in writing, you can't drive all parties and stakeholders to have a consistent understanding. And you have got to get to that point with your business before you purchase some platform and then migrate to it. So there's a whole lot of operational maturity that has to exist. And here's the thing. This is like one of my big hot buttons of all time. Why are people buying stuff for which there's no engineering and implementation plan documented? Well, why would you do that? You're just going to sign a check for $300,000 for something that there's no engineering and implementation plan for it? I mean, I look at this in terms of like a simple server thing. I mean, let's just say it's a $25,000 server. You know, let's say it's not $300,000. Let's just say it's a $25,000 server. How do you as a business decision maker understand that the hardware that's being recommended to you actually will fulfill the requirements if you can't see a written engineering plan and engineering and implementation plan that says, okay, this $25,000 worth of equipment is going to be allocated in this way, and it's going to support these workloads in this way, and this is the life cycle plan, and you know, whatever all that other stuff is that goes into it, you have no way of knowing that that expenditure and the associated project is going to have that outcome. And if you don't pay your architect or engineer to do that design, then if all what you're doing is saying, well, I'm going to go talk to this service provider and I'm going to get a proposal for them. Well, they're not doing an engineering and architecture design for you. And they're sure as heck not going to do it for free. And if they are doing it for free and just giving you a proposal, then I would argue that you're not getting quality out of that process. And you didn't pay for that engineering plan. You didn't pay for that implementation plan. So you can't see it. So you have no way to make an informed decision-making process. You have no way to know that this thing that you're buying, that you're going to have for the next 9 years, is actually meeting your requirements. You just are not putting yourself in a position to make an informed decision as a business leader unless you use the right process. And this is going to be true for virtually any technology. And sitting on a sales demo, I'm sorry, isn't really good enough. It's just really not good enough. You can have your business people, like, you know, your accountants, your bookkeepers, your manufacturing staff, you know, whatever, your people who are not CTO level, you can have them go through all kinds of things. And I'm not saying that their input is not valuable. I think their input is essential. But what I can guarantee you is that if you don't have a CTO reviewing all of that, you will miss things that have astronomically far-reaching effects. I have seen proposals that are pathologically one-sided that, in effect, if the customer signed that proposal, it would result in them being in breach of contract with other key vendors. Well, the CFO didn't catch it. CEO didn't catch it. Corporate counsel didn't catch it. Nobody caught it except me. So what would happen if they didn't include me in that process? You know, these are the things that you can avoid by having a trusted CTO who's available to you. And I can't stress this enough. It's not your PC technician. It's not your server engineer. It's not your network engineer. It's not your IT director. You need somebody that has CTO skills. That is all for now. I hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, if you want to give me feedback, you can use the contact form on our website.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first Saturday of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, go to her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
Support comes from Educators Credit Union. Does your financial institution pay you? At Educators Credit Union, members earn record amounts of cash back with member loyalty. In 2024 will be no different. You're invited to start building your reward today at ecu.com. Support comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, specializing in criminal defense, traffic, and DUIs.